Welcome back to Word and Table, a weekly podcast about liturgy, sacraments, and the great tradition of Christian worship, and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I'm here as always with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome, Father Stephen.
Oh, good to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America. And today we want to make good on first of a series of episodes on the Church Fathers. We talked about them in general a couple of episodes ago, and we just want to start getting into them in particular. And Father Stephen, which Church Father would you start with?
Well, this is sort of odd, but we just celebrated, you know, in the Anglican Church, we have a church calendar,
mm-hmm.
and we just celebrated the commemorance of Athanasius.
Okay.
So sort of starting and jumping ahead, because Athanasius starts the golden age of the church fathers, so he's by no means the first, but he's an extraordinarily important person in church history. You know, the church had a huge crisis with the something called the Arian heresy.
Right, the Arians.
In the late 3rd and 4th century. And it really was a major threat to the faith. And we find out that Athanasius ended up playing a critical role, perhaps the critical role, in successfully defending and enunciating and defending the faith. So he's extraordinary and a very interesting character. I mean, there's a funny story about Athanasius. He had a lot of opponents and things. He's actually exiled. He was bishop for 45 years, and he spent 17 years away from his diocese in various exiles. He's exiled 5 times.
Huh.
But I love this. One of the times, his enemies, this is a famous story with him, accused him of murdering one of theirs, a bishop,
really?
And cutting off his hand and killing him.
Wow.
Happily, they found him in a monastery. He was both alive and with 2 hands. So that sort of solved the case. He actually walks in during the trial. You know, he goes, well, I think that's so much for, you know, the prosecution rests.
Okay. Yeah. That is, so he made some waves in his time.
He certainly did.
Talk about the Arian crisis. Maybe that's a good way to start. What was the issue at stake with the Arians?
Well, the real question is, you know, what is the relationship, you know, to Jesus to the Father? And the issue Arius raised was Jesus, and remember we had this idea in Greek philosophy, I think it really comes from that, was this notion that God is just too perfect to be really connected to an imperfect world. And so
Right. They
always talk about emanations and things, demiurges they call them, things that somehow we're sort of halfway beings between God. And there's a temptation to think of things that way.
Because the idea that God become man is very, very strange, right?
Yeah.
How could he come down to this dirty world and live among us?
Right.
And
so we have this perfect world of the Spirit, and then you had this world, and you'd have various ideas. You sort of came down by level. This is at the heart of something called Gnosticism, but it's very much rooted in Greek philosophy. So it's easy for people who live in that environment to think in terms of Christ being sort of an emanation, a demiurge of the Father. And so Arius began questioning, saying, well, yes, he's the Son of the Father, but he said, wait a second, you got to have, the Father has to exist before there's a Son. So wouldn't that mean that the Father predated the Son? You know, there's a time when there's a Father and not a Son, and wouldn't that make the Father superior?
Mm.
So trying to make something that put the Father at a different level, somehow more God, than Jesus. And that kind of thing, fundamentally questioning whether Jesus is truly the fullness of God coming to humanity, really was called into question. That's important of how we see salvation and things.
Yeah.
So that was what was coming up with Arius. And it was, and again, it was a very dangerous heresy, because it really fit in with what a lot of people expected. It seemed to make a lot of sense for people.
It's really seductive.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about how Athanasius, how did Athanasius push back against this challenge?
Well, it's interesting because he started out as a deacon in his home church. And Alexandria is a very big city, as we've talked about, one of the major cities of the ancient world, mm-hmm. a great center of Christianity. And he ended up very young. He was a deacon at 24. But he was really very talented, and so the bishop actually took him to be his assistant when he went to the first great church council at Nicaea.
As a deacon?
As a deacon.
Wow.
At 325. He took him as a deacon, and he actually was a major player in the debates. And, for example, we talk about, how do you describe what the Father, there's only one God, So how can there be one God, yet Jesus and the Father? And he says, they have one being. They share a common being. Mm. It's called ousia in Greek. Homoousios is the term in Greek. They're consubstantial. They share one being. Uh-huh. That word comes from Athanasius to describe. How do we describe? They share the same being, the same substance in Latin substantia, the same substance. So he was the one who really put, you know, put it in that term. They share one substance.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, that is a huge inheritance of the faith that we have today.
And also, I should say, how did he answer? And it's really the important thing about, what about this thing about, well, gee, the Father must have existed before the Son. He said, no. Because we have to remember the Son, as we say in the Nicene Creed, is begotten before all ages. Hmm. He's eternally begotten. The Son is eternally begotten of the Father. So we assume that one, again, there is no time in God. You know, there never was a time where the Father existed without the Son. They are co-eternal.
Yeah.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There was never a time when there was not the Word. The Word and the Father are inseparable.
Yeah. So it was up to Athanasius ended up being the one to defend the idea that Jesus was both God and man.
Sort of answer the particular questions being raised. Remember, we say often what heresies really are is, remember, we use the example of the DTR, define the relationship.
Right.
You think things are going on, and then somebody says something, it doesn't seem what you thought was going on. And you say, wait a second.
We need to sit down and figure this out.
And what he really did answered those things, you know, in a traditional way. He really put words around the traditional view.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what he was like. I mean, he's obviously a very, very sharp mind. Was he like a professor or something like that?
Well, it's interesting because it's a really good point, because Athanasius didn't have the traditional philosophical background. Alexandria was an extraordinary, it's a great school there. People like Origen had great philosophical educations, and he didn't. He was a churchman. Hmm. And also he was very much more connected with the actual community there. When he later became bishop of Alexandria, he actually preached in Coptic, that's actually Egyptian, is the way the name for the Egyptian language is called Coptic. No one ever done that. They'd always spoken Greek.
Wow.
You know, upper class people did. Christianity started out with Greek speakers. But he actually was connected. He was connected with the early monastics. So he was really connected more that way. He's very, he writes very simply compared to others. He tends to avoid technical terms compared to other writers.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, he's a simple kind of guy. Also, something I think shock our listeners now is people at that time could be very, in their arguments, could be pretty abrupt.
Okay, so he was maybe a little bit peevish.
I don't know the exact adjective, but he certainly, was pretty direct.
I see.
Yes.
Okay. Well, but obviously he was dealing with such a serious challenge to the churches, to the truth, right? I mean.
And also a lot of this, there was a lot of politics involved here that he had to fight off.
Okay.
Because what happened was once we have Christianity become the state religion, is the emperor's thought, starting with Constantine, for example. Constantine agreed. He called the Council of Nicaea. He agreed with that formulation. But the trouble is, Constantine, as an emperor, he thought one of the great values of Christianity, in addition to the faith, was that it would be a source of unity in the empire.
Right.
So when he saw this was tearing people apart, you know, he started pushing for, can't we just split the difference?
Right.
Just use words that you can interpret either way. And so one of the things he really had to fight was sort of a broad view. Why don't we just sort of use words that can go either way?
Yeah, you know, Arians can mean them in this way, yes, and Orthodox Christians
exactly
can mean them
right
in this way.
Oh, so okay, a lot he had to do there. There was a lot of argument that way.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds quite a bit like some of the theological challenges that we've been facing in modern times,
yes,
right? I
exactly
mean, words being used in different ways and things like that. Maybe Athanasius is, maybe there's a lot of lesson to be taken from Athanasius's life.
Another problem that he faced is there was a considerable view by we never had a problem like this in the faith quite like this.
Uh-huh.
And some people understandably resisted bringing in new terms that weren't in the scriptures. So there was a part of people that weren't Arians as such, but the idea of, well, we have to spell this out. Well, gee, you're spelling out using these terms and things that aren't uh-huh in the Bible. They preferred to make just always used to traditional terminology. So you have a lot of different factors that were helping to promote Arianism.
Okay. And Athanasius helped suss them out.
He helped, you know, say, we really have, this is a real deal breaker.
Yeah.
The essence of Christianity is who Jesus is. You know, what Jesus does takes meaning because of who Jesus is.
Right.
And so this is, we really have to get this right, and we can't have any ambiguity about this.
Right.
Actually, it's sort of funny that way, is we don't think of the Nicene Creed, right? It sort of expands on the Apostles' Creed. Mm-hmm. Well, if you think that's expanding, there's something called the Athanasian Creed.
Okay.
That really goes, longer. Must there be any doubts? And it goes on.
Okay.
And the ironic thing there, the Athanasian Creed has actually is falsely attributed to Athanasius.
Got it.
But it has the idea of just spelling things out. So what he wanted to do, what the council did, was to spell out, what that understanding was. Lest there be any doubt.
Okay.
What do we mean, does you be the Son of the Father? What does that actually mean?
Great. Well, can you give any, are there any, so how did his life end up? So you said he was bishop of Alexandria, and this would have been in the 4th century.
Right. He was bishop 45 years, 17 in exile. He had five different exiles for a journey, mm-hmm. total of 17 years. Actually, that turned about to be one of those blessings. Like we like to often say in homiletics and things, if it weren't for the persecution of Stephen, we might still be catechizing, evangelizing uh-huh. Jerusalem. It forced the church to go out there. Well, he spent time in Trier, which is, in Germany.
Uh-huh.
He spent time in Rome. He spent time with the monks in the desert, et cetera, as part of his exiles. And so he helped bring helped really shore things up in the Western church by his presence. He brought a lot of one of the best sellers of the ancient world, as he wrote a life of Anthony the Great, one of the early monastics, one of these great desert heroes. And it was a real bestseller, and people love this. Actually, anyone who's read the Confessions of Augustine probably remember in chapter 8, where Augustine mentions part of his conversion is two guys who've read his book, The Life of Anthony, said, wow, they tell me he was just really moved by that story.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, goodness. Wow.
The book was really important for popularizing the idea of monasticism big time in the West. So it really helped promote the idea of the monastic movement in the West.
Well, that obviously caught on.
That certainly did. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about any more of his writings?
Actually, another important thing is, I'll talk about some of his other writings here, is he... one of the issues that had to be resolved is the Holy Spirit. You see, all the original Nicene Creed isn't what we have today. We had to add on to it because it ends, it says we believe in the Holy Spirit. But it didn't say anything about, what do you mean by the Holy Spirit? So people questioned, are we talking about, is this a creation, a creature?
Uh-huh.
Is it sort of part of God, but like Arians say, but somehow a lower level, a third level of God? And so he argued that the same things are true about Jesus, are true of the Holy Spirit, in the sense he's truly, fully God. He shares one being. And so he helped to clarify that, and he wrote letters to a bishop called, a place called Thuis, and it's Thmuis, I don't know how to pronounce it, in Egypt.
It's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. In Egypt, and he wrote letters to him that really helped spell out that doctrine. And sadly, he died shortly before they revised the Nicene Creed to put those truths in.
Oh, really?
So something really great, he does a really beautiful job explaining, the truth about the Holy Spirit. It plays a key role in the Solomon Conference. The first council was Nicaea, the second was Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
And Constantinople expands, it's no longer we just believe in the Holy Spirit, we believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father, together with the Father and Son, is adored and glorified, who's spoken through the prophets.
Wow.
So that comes in, it's just shortly after he dies. Happily for him, the last 7 years of his life, he actually spent happily in his diocese.
Great. So not exiled.
Not exiled. And his ideas, of course, his defense of orthodoxy. In the Eastern Church, they call him the father of orthodoxy.
Huh.
And he's known as Athanasius the Great. And not to distinguish, there are not any other Athanasiuses.
Yeah.
Just to just say, boy, he's great. So it's not just like we have to worry about how many, like Gregory the Great. There are many Gregories.
Right.
But no, Athanasius the Great.
Really just
the
one.
Defender of orthodoxy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, is there anything else, any other tidbits about Athanasius that you'd share with us?
Yeah. One other thing, if people start looking into his writings, things they'd like to look at is most commonly, people read the life of Anthony. It still reads well today. It's really well written. Yeah, it's a good read. You don't have to force things saying, I should like this. You'll really like the book. It's a good book. Another thing that we would have would be on the Incarnation. Actually, there's originally two works that we often treat as two works. It's just one work originally. One was called Against the Pagans, was Arguments Against Paganism.
Uh-huh.
And then the second half of the book was called, On the Incarnation, talking about the doctrine of Christ. And so that's, I think, the most read work we have of his today. Although something I like is, you might not know, in the ancient world, one of the troubles you had is figuring out what the date of Easter was. I mean, actually, to do the calculation, And so what a bishop would do is they'd send out a letter every year, telling people early in the year, right after Epiphany, you know, so when would Lent begin and things? So they'd send out a letter, you know, when will Easter be this year? They'd send out a letter, and often it would be, have a very pastoral character. And so we still read his pastoral letter, one of his pastoral letters for, you know, an Easter letter. We read one of his Easter letters to this day. It's really good.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay. Great. Well, he helped solidify the doctrine of, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So I guess it'd be fair to say that even if one doesn't know who Athanasius is and you're worshiping in an Orthodox, or theologically Orthodox church, you owe quite a bit to this guy's life.
Yes, I mean, he certainly helped defend that. He helped put words around it. Again, he didn't come up with
doctrine,
but he helped really articulate it in a way that made sense. He articulated that doctrine and really fought for it to make sure when people for other, like, political motives saying, why can't we just sort of disagree and et cetera, saying, no, this is a deal breaker.
Right.
If we don't have who Jesus is down, nothing holds. I mean, it's what Jesus does only counts because of who Jesus is.
Yeah,
you
I find myself really inspired by that message, especially today, especially with the you know, theological controversies that are continuing to go on to this day. For me, it's comforting and encouraging to actually go back and read about a time where the church was facing very similar problems, very similar challenges, but the people that the Lord brought to step up and to meet those challenges directly.
That's right. It's very encouraging.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have for today's episode. And thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back next week with more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.